Welcome to Context Matters. I am Cindy Parker. I am a writer, a speaker, and an educator who loves to gather around the table with interesting people who have different perspectives from me. And then we just talk about God, Bible, theology, and other tangentially related subjects. And I include you in that comment because I enjoy hearing what you think about these topics as well. I've been looking forward to this next mini-series that will take place over the next few weeks. It blends art and music with biblical law and the prophets with modern politics. You won't get all of that in one blow, so don't worry. But please do take this journey with me as we consider things like slavery, Torah, and trauma in a new way. The scholars and artists who are participating in this mini-series are top-notch, and I think that you will be drawn in, even though these are really hard issues to talk about. We begin with my friend, Dr. Mark Glanville. We met as PhD students and clicked over our similar interest in the Book of Deuteronomy. I focused on a theology of place, and he focused on what God said about the stranger in his community. It was years after I met him that I realized he had been a professional jazz musician in his previous life before being a biblical scholar. Dr. Glanville is now the Associate Professor of Pastoral Theology at Regent College in Vancouver, Canada, but he hasn't let go of his roots in jazz. He has written about biblical law and the history of the blues and jazz and how they are both birthed out of slavery. I knew I wanted to invite him onto the podcast. I am also very aware of the fact that we are both white and can only talk from an outsider's perspective about the poignancy and the richness of how jazz was born out of pain and suffering and yet speaks life into a community. But don't worry, we will get an insider's look as well later on in the series. But we need a quick introduction to jazz and biblical law and what connects the two. But I'm also very curious about how an Australian kid got bitten by the jazz bug. And then how did that same kid end up getting a PhD in biblical studies? So Mark Glanville takes us all the way back to the beginning.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a national park west of Sydney, Australia, called the Blue Mountains, which was very beautiful, a eucalypt national park. It's kind of a beautiful mountain with a blue haze because of the eucalyptus oil. So I grew up doing a lot of hiking, about what we call bushwalking in Australia, yep. The proper term. And we played a lot of music. My brother's a professional jazz drummer. And I, as a young adult, worked as a professional jazz pianist for years, and we played a lot together. And so that was really wonderful. And I have a sister as well. So our early years, there was a lot of music. As young adults, it just became our life, and immersing in the sounds of jazz and in the middle of that national park and an hour's drive to Sydney to play gigs and rehearse with other musicians. Yeah, that was something of our childhood, you know, in our young adult lives.
Was it your parents who, I mean, where does the musical talent come from?
Yeah, it's a funny question. I think that both my parents have really good musical ability, but I think perhaps, I mean, they grew up in the Depression, post-Second World War in Sydney, both in poorer families, so neither had the opportunity to learn music, you know, but my mother in particular would take us to concerts and classical concerts and Gilbert and Sullivan musicals, you know, and made us practice, and she had to kind of force us to practice with threat of really death, you know, up until I was 12, you know, so she did really well at that. And my father, a family joke is he can play the theme song to Bonanza on the guitar, you know. that's his treasure.
If you and your brother have gone professional with jazz, where did the jazz connection, did you just happen to have an affinity towards jazz? How were you drawn into that genre of music?
Yeah, I mean, that is such an interesting question, I think, for students of music. In Australia, it's not like America and Canada, which is a place where jazz was formed and birthed. I mean, jazz is America's classical music, really, native classical music. In Australia, we're a long way from improvised music. And so when kids learn, they learn classical music, the classical tradition, and which is fine, but I never really practiced hard, not nearly enough to be a professional classical musician. I just didn't like it enough. But I would play church music, which is sort of improvised music. I'm playing with chords. I remember doing that from age 12 for hours at our piano, and which wasn't proper practice, according to, you know, my music teacher. And I just remember talking to my mother once in my teenage years saying, "Mom, I'm just aware of this kind of music that where people just sort of make it up. Like they kind of work it out as they go along. Is that called jazz?" And she says, "I think it is, you know." And so I just would talk to anyone I could find who could, as a teenager, who could teach me about this improvised music. And it wasn't until I was literally 18, which is very late compared to North America or Canada for a professional musician, I found a professional jazz teacher. And then sky was the limit. I was just ready to practice. And once I hit my stride, I was practicing 8 hours a day. You know, it was just my life, just totally immersed in these sounds. I started to experience what some of those visual artists experience who went a little bit crazy from over-practicing, you know, over-painting, you know, like Van Gogh.
So what then was the religious context for you in your family? Was there a religious background there at all?
That was, yeah, thanks. That's a multicolored reality for me. I grew up in Australian evangelicalism, which really doesn't translate to US evangelicalism, because there's no such thing as a Republican Party. It's not the politics in the same way. So it's an evangelicalism that's the sovereignty of God, the lordship of Christ, the authority of Scripture. So that was the central stream. Another interesting stream is my father was influenced, because he was a Christian school principal in a Dutch Reformed school, he was influenced by continental kind of Reformed theology, Abraham Kuyper, Herman Bavinck, where there is a deep understanding of, a deep theology of creation, that the world is made with care and delight, and that God calls God's people into every sphere of society because the whole lot matters to God. So vocation matters, and sports matters, and the arts matters, and economics matters, and politics matters. And so I had this growing up. My father would talk to me about it. However, I knew it as words, but I didn't quite agree with it. I couldn't make sense of it. And it wasn't until I really, to be honest, I got to seminary and started to read people like Oliver O'Donovan, Resurrection and Moral Order, and Colin Gutton's books, a now deceased English theologian, that I said, oh, that's what Dad was talking about. You know, this world really does matter to God. God did create a world with care and delight, and all the implications for Christian discipleship.
So it's interesting, though, because we're running parallel tracks. We have the jazz music track, and then you have the spiritual track. And if they're coming together for you anyway, closer to like when you're at seminary, at what point in life did seminary come along? If you were playing gigs and doing jazz music, why isn't jazz your career?
Yeah, sure. Sometimes I wonder that myself, Cindy, with regret. The arts is just so human. And for those who are created to be in the arts, and not everyone is, it just speaks right to the center of who you are as a person. So this interview is, I think, my favorite podcast I've ever done, because we get to talk and play music as well as talk about theology. So that's... But in my own story, it was in my late 20s that I got an acute repetitive strain injury. And so from the grief of that, I just stopped playing, which is just, you know, in God's providence what I did. I could have continued to play, I think, but just the shock and the grief. I was playing, practicing 8 hours a day, then doing gigs and rehearsals, just this nuts kind of young adult immersion in the arts is... many young adult artists do, but it was unsustainably physically. And then I went just to work towards, slowly work toward a PhD in Old Testament that you too have done. And we met as we were pursuing PhDs, of course. But, you know, the integration, Cindy, I think is still happening, to be honest. I think it'll sort of happen to the day I die. It didn't happen straight away. You know, I mean, we've spoken about a thick theology of creation, but just hearing the truth of humanity and the truth of God in the music and experiencing that in the music is a part of my life journey, I think. Yeah, I mean, we can talk about, I think, the deep visceral connections, the deep historical connection, the deep human connections, and I'd love to do that. But I think it's dawning on me slowly, you know. I think really when I transition from jazz music to studying the Hebrew Bible, to studying the Old Testament, Making all those connections has been a gradual process.
You talk about how it was in one of the papers that you wrote for a journal, and you said that your two vocational love affairs emerge from the horror of enslavement. And so, of course, jazz birthed here in the U.S. based on the enslavement of Africans in this nation, and then the biblical law codes, which you and I have both studied, birthed out of the enslavement of the Israelites in Egypt. And I find it so interesting that in you, in the way that life has unfolded for you, these two concepts get to be married together, which gives you this whole other layer of a way to help explain it to people. So I have so many thoughts and so many questions.
Great.
And these are all such big, huge topics. I mean, the blues and jazz, lynching in the United States and the Bible. Let's maybe start with music. Maybe we could just talk about the emotion that sits inside of or is encapsulated in the blues and in jazz.
Yeah, thanks. What a wonderful question. I mean, I do think just to connect them as we start, as you have connected them, I mean, it's just remarkable to me that jazz music and the blues music and biblical law have both been birthed in historical conditions of slavery. So, of course, we're talking about the Israelites enslaved in Egypt, and then they come to Sinai 2.5 months later to receive the law. And jazz and blues music, and the significant thing for me there is they both connect with my heart so deeply, but they both connect with the human heart so deeply. Mm-hmm. I mean, the law was canonized. It's in Scripture. It doesn't just form ancient Israel, but Jesus embodies it and fulfills it and is finally that human being who embodies what the law is all about and lives out what the law is all about for the sake of all of humanity. And so somehow just the deep, visceral humanity that's there in these two art forms, if you like, one literary, one musical, that were birthed in just horrific oppression. That's so significant, I think, just to name that. And that doesn't in any way validate the oppression, neither, certainly not, the oppression of the lynching era or of slavery in North America when it comes to jazz and blues. That's an outrageous evil, period. And similarly, ancient enslavement that we read about in the Bible and in many historical texts. But nonetheless, the human resilience, the cry of humanity that we see in biblical law and the blues connects with us and echoes through history and has both genres have shaped history. So with the blues, I mean, it's those two things, I think. The blues, I mean, I'll just play you a couple of... Those sounds are a blues moan, but a gospel shout. As many people have said, and as Otis Moss III says it so beautifully in his recent book, Blue Note Preaching, it's a blues moan and a gospel shout. In other words, it sings the resilience of a people, but also the moan of a people in the context of just outrageous evil oppression. And James Cone, in his book Crossing the Lynching Tree, tells the story so beautifully of the African American people in during the lynching era of 1880 to 1940, which is the very time period when the blues emerged, that on the Friday nights and Saturday nights there was this celebration of life in the juke joints where the blues was played and there was dancing and laughter. And then on Sunday morning, this celebration but also deep lament in the presence of the Lord where the gospel blues was sung and hymns both from the African-American community and also reappropriating kind of classical Western hymns, but with this blues moan and gospel shout. And so in the blues, we have the blues moan, which is just singing the song of the experience of oppression. But we have this gospel shout, which is this deep resilience that is so core through this people, this resilient people, and in the presence of God. And you hear both in the blues. And what's just so important to realize is that the blues wouldn't have its sound without that history, that it's such a precious sound and such a sacred sound because of that history. It's a spiritual history and it's a very human history that comes from outrageous evil and wonderful human resilience. I mean, I could talk about that kind of in terms of the music if you would like and try and explain a little bit about the nature of that sound.
Yeah, I think that's really key because we can talk about the words that are also sung, but in the music, hearing it in the music, I'd love for you to give an example of how we're hearing that lament over the oppression in the actual notes themselves.
And then maybe we could kind of take it to the African-American theology. So for the musicians on the call here, Cindy, listening to the podcast, let's think that we're, say, in the key of C, in a tonality of C. And what we, in the blues, we speak about blues notes. There's three blues notes in any given key. And it's the blues notes that give the blues its distinctive sound. It's not just that. It's also the time and the way, just the way it's played that's almost, you almost can't describe it. And you just have to listen to it and learn it. But the blues notes, the first one is what we call the flattened seventh. And in the key of C, that'd be B flat. Instead of B, which it would be in a major scale, it's B flat. So there's the B flat there. And the second blues note is what we call the flattened third or the minor third. So in a major scale, it would be C to E would be the third. But in a minor key, but certainly with a blues tonality, it's C to E flat as the third. I'm sure you recognize that. And then the third blues note is the flattened fifth. So kind of a regular fifth or what we call in classical music a perfect fifth is C to G. But in the blues tonality, it's a flattened fifth, which would be G flat. And you can hear that interval between the C and the G flat, which is perhaps the sharpest of all. There it is again. And so using these three blues notes, it's kind of overly rationalistic in a way to describe such beautiful music in technical terms, but these are the three tonalities that gives the blues its beautiful sound. And of course, what these notes are doing, you know, if you just play a major third, C to E, it's not a dissonant sound. It's a fairly harmonious sound. But if you flatten that third, there's more of a tension in the music very naturally and even physically. The way the waveforms relate brings a certain tension or dissonance to our ear and to our heart and emotional level. And so these blues notes and the blues, it expresses something of, it's a lament. It expresses even in harsh tones when it comes to the flattened five, an outrage and a lament. But because it's music and it's so creative, it can't help at the same time to be a certain celebration of life. At the very least, you know, it's saying we survived and we are surviving together.
I would love to hear, like, if we put this together just to kind of sharpen our ears and to show us a lot more explicitly what it means to listen to something in a blues way versus the original way. Maybe play Amazing Grace the way that a lot of people would be accustomed to hearing Amazing Grace, and then give us Amazing Grace that has all of that dissonant emotive aspect to it based on the blues or jazz.
Yeah, great. Okay. Well, I'll play Amazing Grace, first of all, just with kind of standard, what we might call kind of major chords or chords based on the major scale. And so there won't be that same kind of dissonance or tension in the music. The waveforms will work together more harmoniously. ¶¶ So there's obviously Amazing Grace is the way to be played in most churches. And so now let's just play it again. So straight away, the time has a certain kind of blues feel, and that almost can't be measured. And now let's play that major chord again. I'm in the key G. And I'm playing the blues third there. There's a major chord, and now let's flatten it to the seventh, that blues note, the seventh. And now let's get this, put this flattened third to work. G7, which is the flattened seventh.
That was awesome.
Awesome. So, there is so much packed in there, right? The first version of Amazing Grace we played was nice enough, right? But it lacked a certain depth, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the second version, it speaks to something that I think almost every human being recognizes as deeply human. It connects with us at a celebratory level, but we recognize it as a very deep tradition. What is it about humanity? What is it about the story of the world that beauty is birthed out of extreme and atrocious suffering, and atrocious evil? You know, what is it about the world that beauty is birthed through human resilience, through the presence of Christ, through the worship of a people, in a way that, and it's significant to me too, that, I mean, the white supremacy that created the atrocity didn't birth the same beauty artistically. As a perpetrator of atrocious evil, there's such an erasure of who we are as human beings. And I mean, this is the part of every human experience, I think. It's true of every culture and of every person, one way or another. How does that track with theology, too? You know, if that's true of art, is it true of theology as well?
Well, I was just going to try to bring these two things into conversation with each other. If the blues is something of this cry of the oppressed, it makes me think of all the times in the Hebrew Bible that there was oppression and there was a crying out to God. And God responds, and he responds in very big, dramatic ways. I mean, and it's not just the Israelites out of Egypt. It's Sodom and Gomorrah. The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is due to the cry of the oppressed. And so we have these instances where God shows up in mighty ways to sit on the side of the oppressed. And so I just wonder if there's a way that in letting the blues hold hands with biblical theology, what that does to introduce us to more of the emotive feeling of understanding God on the side of the oppressed.
You and I both know, Cindy, of just that narrative of the Old Testament story of the first chapter of the book of Exodus, that God's people, the Hebrew people, are horrifically oppressed. They're an enslaved nation, to use that term loosely. They're put into forced labor in the brick factories of Pharaoh to build these store cities of Pithom and Ramesses. And of course, there's this genocidal dynamic where male babies are slaughtered to keep this subjected people subjected. And so that really to fund Pharaoh's program of aggrandizing and economic accumulation, it's just kind of classic slavery, people expended for the sake of economic productivity, as it has been in so many cultures. And when God steps in then, and that we encounter this great Exodus event in Exodus chapter 12 to 14, God, in ancient terms, it's a great act of slave emancipation. It's not just an Exodus event where God kind of shows his power, as sometimes we can think of in modern theology. In ancient terms, it's slave emancipation. We don't see it because we're not a slave culture. But any slave culture recognizes, no, this is a God who's stepping in and emancipating slaves. And in doing that, in Exodus 12 to 14, God's showing God's character as the one who does hear the cry of the oppressed. As God says by the burning bush to Moses, Exodus chapter 3 and 4, I hear your cry, I see the suffering, I know the suffering. I see, I hear, I know, God says. God's attentive to the cry of the oppressed. And that comes out throughout the Bible. And then 2.5 months later, after a period of wilderness wanderings, we arrive at Sinai. And I think what we forget is the narrative arc of the Sinai experience, that these people are at the foot of Sinai with the wounds from the Egyptian whip still raw on their back. And so when they receive these laws, when they receive the Ten Commandments and this bunch of wonderful laws that goes with them, this isn't even a nation of ex-slaves. This is a nation of slaves just recently been released, desperate for a word from this emancipating God. And we see that with the law, God is shaping a community to operate in the way that God has always wanted communities to operate. God, the way that God created humanity to live together in community from the beginning, a place of flourishing for every person, especially for the least, a community that brings the weakest to the center of the community. And so, for example, we read Deuteronomy 15:4, there should be no poor among you. And so we read in Deuteronomy 15, these laws seriously restricting slavery. And in Deuteronomy 23, laws concerning slaves, slavery that says a slave can run away if they need to, which really means that slavery is barely exists at all in any kind of way that we would usually understand it. And so these laws are given to shape a community that's consistent with this slave emancipating God. It's beautiful, you know, to think this is our God. And so when we see the tenderness of Jesus, when we come to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when we see the tenderness of Jesus healing lepers and making the blind see and eating meals with all the, inverted commas, wrong people, but really the right people in the sight of God. You know, Luke 15, 1 and 2, this man befriends tax collectors and sinners and eats with them. You know, Jesus didn't invent that. In the context of the biblical story and in the mind of the authors of the Gospels, Jesus is being what Israel was always supposed to be. Of course, Jesus is a king on David's line, fulfilling what God was shaping Israel to be. This is our God. This is our Savior. And, I mean, we can see so much packed in there, but we can see the outlines of a missional theology straight away.
We have so much more to cover, and I'm sorry to say, but you will have to wait until next week to hear more from Dr. Glanville, although I will play us out with his version of Amazing Grace. Next week, we talk about why there must be a blues moan when we look at our history, and yet the gospel shout is always nearby. We also talk about a layer of anger that can be heard in elements of jazz music. Make sure you like or follow this podcast so you don't miss out. The ability to bring these conversations to you is possible because of my Patreon team. People like Lisa and Asuka Abaya make this podcast sustainable and commercial free for all of you. If you want to be part of the Patreon team, you will find a link in the episode notes of the show. As always, it is wonderful to sit and exchange ideas with you at this virtual table. The talented Peter Lordson of Sycamore Sound created the opening music, and Mark Glanville played all the piano segments. I look forward to our conversation next week, and until then, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you.